Happy birthday, Ernest Hemingway. Happy birthday.
Are we singing?
Ernest Hemingway.
Oh, this is going to be so bad. If we sing, and we should sing, Nick, you're going to have to sync it up. It'll be terrible.
We already have sung.
Yes.
Ooh. Hello, welcome to You Don't Know Lit, a weekly literature podcast. You dummy.
Yeah. Hey, who are we alienating today?
Dummies. Oh, this week, in honor of Ernest Hemingway's birthday, I have grown up my mustache, and I'm looking for his best book. To help me are my very, very, very good friends, Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. Nick, I'm working on my beard as well. It's the first time I've ever had one. Thank you. If you are looking for a book by Ernest Hemingway, I would recommend maybe his most famous book, The Old Man and the Sea.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, and I just recently shaved off any vestige of facial hair I had. since we're doing beard updates, this is... Nick, if you're looking for a book by Papa Hemingway, and that is what his nickname was, mm-hmm. Papa Hemingway.
Pop, 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 pop.
If you're looking for a book by Papa Hemingway, I think you should read his first major novel, The Sun Also Rises, which is about drinking and bullfights, in that order.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Wow. I think... Ian, shaving off any semblance of facial hair that you had is really not in the spirit of this week's episode.
No, it's not. I'm disqualifying myself from contention.
I'm sorry, Ian. You've lost this week.
That's where
I forgot to mention that to you guys, that you need hair as well in order to qualify.
Hey, guys. I just want you to know that over the course of this episode, I'm super hyped for this episode, by the way. I'm going to be referring to things using the Heming prefix. So you know how like we add gate to things when there's scandals, like Pizzagate? I'm going to refer to things using this prefix Hemingway. So I would like to start today, if it's okay with you, by playing a game called Heming Fact or Heming Fake. And some of these are real and some of them are fake. So
fantastic.
The way this game works is I will tell you a statement and... you have to tell me whether it's a Heming fact or...
what do we have to
you
do?
You have to tell me if it's a Heming fact or a Heming fake.
Oh, okay.
And then I will...
let me write these rules down.
Yeah.
So, Ian, I have a question for you. Yes. I've done some research for this episode on Ernest Hemingway as well. I participating in this game, or is this a game for Nick?
Hey, Joe. I've done no research, so I could just play the game if you want.
Hey, Joe, do you want to collaborate on this?
Yeah, we could collaborate on this.
Okay, because I'm sure you've got some... you've got some Heming facts that I don't have, so.
Yeah, and one thing I noticed, Ian, and is a lot of the Heming facts, when you're researching Hemingway, are really difficult to peel apart from the Heming fictions. Wait, what did you call them? Heming fakes?
Heming fake. I thought about Heming fiction. I think Heming fiction could work well.
No, I like Heming fake. I like Heming fake.
A literary term. That's good.
It's good.
Good.
Yeah.
So you can drop yours in, Joe, as you see fit.
All right, I'm ready to do this. I'm ready to make you guys proud.
And what are you gonna say? Are you gonna say true or false? Or are you gonna say Heming fact or Heming fake?
Heming fake.
Good. Okay.
That's my first answer.
You figured it out. Okay. Here is the first detail. He was Ernest Hemingway was in back to back airplane crashes.
God, I hope it's true. Heming fact.
It is a Heming
fact.
That
is a Heming fact.
He was in two airplane crashes in 2 days. The first one was just an airplane crash. The second one, he was going to get medevaced in a plane, and they put him in the plane, and then the plane blew up. So that's a good
one. So, Nick, I have a follow-up one for that Heming fact and Heming fake. In that second plane crash, in order to get out of the door, he had to headbutt it open. Heming fact or Heming fake?
Considering I just learned that he was in a medically incapacitated state, I'm going to go with Hemming fake.
Yeah, so I don't know.
All right. Oh, this is a Hemming I don't know.
Well, this is one of those things that, like, this shows up a lot in, like, when you're reading accounts of this second plane crash. Like, people are like, yeah, then he headbutt the door open. And I have yet to find a sufficient source. Ian, do you have any insight on this?
I don't.
Is there a lot of Hemming tall tales?
Well, this is the thing. It's crazy. Like, he sort of courted, like, drama and crazy stuff. He like, pursued this, I feel like.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. All right. Give me another.
Okay. Here's another statement. Hemming factor, Hemming fake. He went shark fishing using dynamite.
That's a Hemming fake. That doesn't even physically. That doesn't make sense.
You're right. It is a Hemming fake. He actually used a machine gun.
Ah, that was Moby Dick that did that.
He used a machine gun. He was fishing, and there were sharks eating his fish, and so he shot the sharks with a machine gun. But
he seems to have a real Hunter S. Thompson vibe going on right now.
So, Nick, I've got a Hemming factor, Hemming fake for you.
Okay.
During World War II, Hemingway was living in Cuba. That's just a fact to begin with.
He spoiled it for you.
Spoilers.
He petitioned the Cuban government for money so that he could outfit his boat, his fishing boat, to hunt German submarines. He asked for machine guns, he asked for bazookas, and all sorts of munitions so that he could sink German submarines in the Gulf of Mexico. Hemming fact or Hemming fake?
I'm concerned about this. First of all, that's very specific. So I'm going to go Hemming fact, unless you're going to like pull the rug underneath me and it's like, no, it's actually the Gulf of somewhere else. All right. I'm fiction. Hemming fiction.
Hemming. Well, that's not one of the options.
Hold on. Hemming fact.
Hemming fact. Is it a fact?
It is a Hemming fact. And during World War II, he did outfit his fishing boat to hunt German submarines.
Seems like Joe's really taken over this game with bad examples.
I've got one for you. It's a little bit.
Please finish this off, Ian.
Move away. Oh, I have so many more. I have at least.
Yeah,
two.
I know.
Here's another.
I have 37 of these.
Cool. Here's another. He had a six-toed cat named Snowflake. Hemming fact or Hemming fake?
I think that's a Hemming fact. I feel like I've heard that before.
It's actually a Hemming fake. His six-toed cat was named Snowball.
Oh, Ian, you're the worst kind of teacher, aren't you?
Yeah, really fucking stupid. Cool. I guess you win, Ian. All right.
You fooled us all.
So this week, we are doing something a little different and focusing on two books by the same author. Normally, we do completely different genres. Well, not genres, but two completely different books, usually. So, guys, please keep in mind our rules here. They're quite simple. Only unavoidable spoilers, omit unnecessary words, Joe, and winning is everything.
Omit needless words.
Yeah, I'd like your 30-second plot, Joe. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Go.
The Old Man of the Sea, written by Ernest Hemingway in 1952, is about an old man who catches a really, really big fish.
Okay, you have 18 seconds.
As he wrestles the fish over 3 days, hauls it in, and struggles against the elements to bring it to the dock, we see a short tale of masculinity pitched against nature. Calm, strength, fearless confidence, and hyper-competence. It's a book that won Ernest Hemingway both the Pulitzer Prize and the Nobel Prize.
Perfect timing. I would have, unbelievable. It sounded very scripted.
It is written out in front of me. I have taken to writing these at a time.
You know, it's kind of bullshit that
you don't perfectly ad lib a 30-second summary of your 100-page book off the top of your head. What's your problem?
You know what? Hey, Ian, you know what I'm going to start doing is I'll just start changing the amount of time. This week, I'm going to need 28 seconds, 33.
We're penalized if we don't completely fill up the time either.
Ian, yeah. Please, in 29 seconds, tell me what your book is about and go.
The Sun Also Rises is a novel about a few weeks in the life of a young American journalist and his friends. So we get a slice of their cafe life in Paris. They go on a fishing trip in the Basque country, and then they go to this week-long bullfighting fiesta in Pamplona, Spain. So the title refers to how life is cyclical, and the story leaves you wondering, Have the events of this book changed these people, or are they just back where they started with worse alcoholism?
Wow. That's time, too.
That's good. Hey, Nick, we've beaten your game. You may have won Hemming Fact or Hemming Fake, but we have beaten your game.
Well, like any segment in this show, I will change the rules very soon on you guys.
Mercilessly.
Good fantastic. Times. Well, you know what? Hey, spoilers. I've read Old Man and the Sea.
Yeah.
And I have a Hemming game for you guys.
Oh, no.
Are you guys ready for that?
I'm Hemming ready.
Are you Hemming ready?
I'm Hemming. Hemming. Ah, shit.
He's Hemming and Hine.
You got to it before I did. I was about to say it, too.
All right. The Old Man and the Sea was originally titled Moby Dick. Is that a Hemming fact or Hemming fake? I'll let you both answer. Do you need to discuss?
I'm going to say, hey, Joe, you want to talk aside in a second?
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, just don't listen.
Yeah.
I'll mute my mic.
Can you take your headphones?
I think,
that is how it works.
I think it was actually originally titled Moby Quick, not Moby Dick.
Yeah.
I think he's trying to get it.
Yeah, you know, the one piece of credence that this might have is, do you know how they make like CSI and it's really popular, and then they make CSI Miami?
I can hear everything that they're saying right now.
And like CSI Miami, CSI New York. I'm really afraid this was originally titled Moby Dick, Cuba.
Oh, you're probably right.
Yeah. I'm going to need the answer. It's been 29 seconds.
Nick, we're ready. Ian, would you like to answer?
Let's answer in unison.
All right. We think this is a Hemming fake. Yeah. Perfect unison.
Because it was actually that lag. It was actually either originally titled Moby Quick or
Moby Dick, Cuba.
Now, when he goes fishing, Joe,
yes,
that is in the Bay of Pigs, correct?
It is in the Gulf. It's in the Gulf. It's in the. He says it's the Gulf Stream. So
in the air. Joe, tell me about The Old Man and the Sea. Let's start with you because I've read it and I'm excited to hear about Ian's too. So I need something to look forward to. So let's get your book.
Something to get you through the next hour of recording.
Well, I think.
Please hurry up.
I don't care who goes first. I do think it should be Ian because Ian is Hemingway's first novel. That's one thing that we didn't talk about, right? The Sun Also Rises is the first novel that Hemingway publishes. And I am the last novel that Hemingway publishes in his lifetime.
Well, this is going to be a prequel, so fucking hurry up. I make the rules, baby.
All right. All right. So, Nick, The Old Man and the Sea, as you know, because you have read this book, is about an old man who catches a big fish. Nick, what? So a little bit peek behind the curtain. You accidentally read this book, correct?
Who told you this information?
You did. You thought you were reading Moby Dick. Is that correct?
Well, I thought Moby Dick was going to show up. Yeah. And then, I mean, it didn't, like, I didn't finish the book still looking for Moby Dick. Like, I did figure out pretty quickly that Moby Dick was not going to happen.
Moby Dick does have a little known literary fact. Moby Dick does have a cameo on page 27.
27.
It's just a shadow that passes under the boat. Right. But that is, we have decided, Moby Dick. So when you read this book, I think if you read this book, just taking it at face value, taking it as a story, I really wonder, what did you think of this when you read it? Like, what were your hot takes on this when you read this book? What did you think it was about?
I think this is one of those books that's so overtly symbolic that, and like a metaphor, I think everybody has a different definition. That's what I think. I think it's forever, whatever you want. I think it's overcoming things.
Wait, so did you feel like you couldn't read it at face value? Because it was just like, well, there has to be some symbol here.
Yeah, no, I thought the book was about an old man that went fishing.
So, Nick, I think
would you say that analysis is correct and that there was no deeper meaning?
So when I first read this book, I was in 10th grade, right? I was in my 10th grade English class. And I, like so many 10th grade English classes, had this teacher and this class in which we just tortured the book. Like, we strapped it to a chair, we like peeled its fingernails back, and we like demanded that it revealed its meaning, right?
This is why people hate English teachers.
100%. Like, exactly.
Like, trying to think about the book as something to be decoded.
That's exactly it. Like, the book was a puzzle
hey, Billy, what was the ocean to you? Oh, God.
Yeah. Like, I have this distinct memory. And I, of course, liked this English class because I was a nerd and I liked all my English classes. So I have nothing but charity in my heart for this teacher.
Goes without saying.
But I distinctly remember talking about, like, the old man baiting his hooks and how he would stab the fish through their eyes and how, like, the eyes are the window to the soul. And the old man had his eyes that were the same color as the sea, is a point that's brought up a couple of times, and really, like, deconstructing this, looking for meaning in this.
I think these are fun things to Google on your own and never talk about to anybody.
Yeah. So, Nick, I think you're going to be surprised to hear that Ernest Hemingway says, quote, "There is no symbolism in this book." sea.
Love it.
What a bunch of fucking bullshit.
He says, and he goes on, he says, "There isn't any symbolism. The sea is the sea. The old man is an old man. The boy is a boy. And the fish is a fish. The That's sharks are all fake. Sharks, no better and no worse. All the symbolism that people say is shit. What goes beyond is what you see beyond when you know."
That's pretty endearing. I'd say that's a Heming fake, though. I know why he said that, but obviously that's bullshit.
Yeah, so Hemingway, he does.
And I love it. It's tongue in cheek. If you want to be that type of. Are you kidding? Ian, have you read this book?
No, I actually haven't. I mean, I know of it. Like, I know that it like lends itself to symbolism. But like some authors, like especially having read Sun Also Rises, like he writes it in this very like spare sort of the iceberg theory. His idea that like there should be a lot more under the surface. But like it's just like
next
there.
You're gonna tell me that Titanic didn't have symbolism.
The movie or the book?
The iceberg.
Oh. Yes, the iceberg symbolizes hubris. I don't know. I think authors do this a lot, and I do tend to believe them when they say it. At the same time, I don't really care that they're saying it.
Yeah.
So like Tolkien does this. Tolkien does this with The Lord of the Rings.
Is this a Hobbit fact?
Oh yeah, a Hobbit fact. Most hobbits have dark hair. So in the movies, where three of the kind of four main hobbits have light hair, that is actually kind of like a bit wrong because most hobbits are born with dark hair and have dark hair throughout their lives.
So Legolas was kind of not a hobbit at all.
No, for multiple reasons.
Not a very accurate hobbit.
No. I think that's something all of us can agree on. Legolas was not an accurate hobbit.
One of the most controversial things we've said on this show.
Hot take. Tolkien did this with symbolism in The Lord of the Rings. People were like, oh, it's an allegory for, you know, like, the moral fight or even for Christianity. And Tolkien was like, no, it's not. I did not write this as an allegory. It has no symbolism. Authors do this. They say, but, and I think they believe
okay,
it.
No.
It doesn't. They say, when I wrote this, I was not leaving a code for you to decode.
Tolkien wrote 8,000 pages of this world or whatever. How many pages? Whatever. Like, he created this entire world, this entire story. This book is what, like 150 pages, and it's about a man and a sea. Like, when he, it's like so obviously a metaphor for whatever the fuck he was thinking about.
I think reading it at face value is interesting. And I love that last piece that he says, where he says, what goes beyond is what you see beyond when you know. Because this book, on the surface,
that should be the answer all authors or writers give. So I do agree with you, Ian. Like, he has to say this. He can't say, oh yeah, the sea is humanity. Right. Like, he can't. Like, any creator can't do that. It's the worst. It's like, oh yeah, this song was actually about having tea in the morning. It's like, oh, all right then.
Well,
cool.
That's it. The song is over. Let's move on.
You've removed my creativity.
Oh,
from,
I see what you're saying. So like this is the way that he keeps it open for people to critique it. Like if he doesn't ever say like the fish is a representation of capitalism, then people will constantly keep fighting. Uh-huh. Okay.
We'll stop arguing about the metaphor.
Yeah,
Joe,
so
tell us. Actually, Joe.
Yep.
Hey, you guys want a one-star review? I do think it's relevant.
One-star review. Let's hear it.
All right. It's a one-star review from Linus. Linus? Linus?
Linus Torvald, creator of Linux.
A lot of people will hate me for this, but I fucking hate The Old Man and the Sea. It was so boring. And yeah, I get it. It's a metaphor. I don't fucking care.
Speaking truth to power.
Yeah. Wow. So, Joe, I agree. Why aren't there some more interesting things? If you're going to make a book about a metaphor, why not include, you know, robots and more explosions?
Shooting sharks with a machine gun. Hey, wait.
Yeah,
Joe,
why weren't there sharks with laser beams?
Does he shoot any sharks with a machine gun?
He does not shoot any sharks. He does stab a shark with a harpoon, and then he loses the harpoon. Later on, he straps his knife to an oar to make a makeshift harpoon, and he stabs a shark with that and loses that one as well. And once he loses both harpoons, he punches a shark.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's good.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. I like that. And
yep, no symbolic, no metaphor there. Keep going, Joe.
The Santiago, the old man of the title, he's an old man. He's well past his prime. He was once this great, like, strong man. Like, he was famous in his region for winning mm-hmm. this 24-hour arm wrestling contest Ooh. Where he and this
sounds miserable.
Well, it was
what?
So he's famous in his village, or was famous when he was younger, because
I don't remember this.
Yeah, so he was in an arm wrestling. And when I say contest, I fear that you think it's like a bracketed system where he like fought multiple people or arm wrestled multiple people. No, it was one contest against one guy that started at sunup on one day and went until sunup the other day. Like,
wait,
the next
hang
day.
On.
Like, yes.
So wait, is it just, is it one long bout? Like, it took 24 hours to tire out the other guy? Or are they like best of 800?
It is one long bout where for 24 hours, he and this guy at a bar in this arm wrestling contest stayed at more or less a stalemate, not giving ground one way or the other until people started to complain in the bar because they had to go to work the next day. So they're like, hey, we should just call this a draw. And at that moment, Santiago, as a young man, like dug deep in himself and slammed this other guy's hand to the ground after 24 hours of perseverance, right? 24 hours of outlasting the other guy.
These guys must have been just incredibly evenly matched.
Apparently. Santiago is incredibly manly. And I actually have a question for you two guys, because
oh boy,
I'm going to go out on a limb.
How manly are you?
I'm also very manly.
Yes. You know where I'm going. I'm going to go out on a limb.
No, I don't.
And I'm going to ask you. I don't know if I want to ask you or accuse you.
Accuse.
Yeah,
accuse
I'm going
is
to
always
accuse
better.
You.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
Really big.
All right.
I want to know, what is your relationship with manliness? And maybe a better way to think of that is, do you think of yourself as a manly person?
As someone who just shaved all of my facial hair, my relationship with masculinity is fraught. To be serious, Joe, personally, I think much like sort of political engagement, I'm not like on one side or the other. Like, I'm not going to be pro or anti. I think there are a lot of negative elements that have been associated with masculinity, manliness. But there are certain things like chopping wood that have been associated with being a dude, and I like chopping wood. So I guess I would say issues based.
Yeah, I grew a mustache, Joe, so I don't know how much more clear I could be.
Yeah, problem solved. So my stance is clear. I was thinking about this. When you read this book, you can't help but think about manliness. And I was thinking about manliness in my own life, because when I was growing up, I grew up, as you guys know, and as the loyal litheads know, I grew up on a dairy farm mm-hmm. in Wisconsin. And
manliest place on earth.
The manliest mm-hmm. place on earth. And Nick, you know my dad. Nick, how would you describe my dad as manly?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you care to elaborate on that?
No.
Okay.
In honor of his manliness, I will not elaborate on that.
My dad is an incredibly likable guy, an incredibly charismatic guy, but he is undeniably a manly guy. And for me, growing up on the farm, this was, I don't want to say it was ever challenging to me, but this was not my lifestyle at all, right? Like, I did the work on the farm. I helped him out, but I never liked it. I hated it. I thought it was boring. Like, I liked reading books. I liked playing tennis. And these are not hyper masculine endeavors. Go ahead.
Joe, come sit on my couch. Talk to us.
Well,
tell us everything.
When I was a little kid, we would have with my friends,
in the beginning.
Have these things called manliest man contests. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yep. These manliest man contests. And they were these things. It was essentially you would dare your friends to do stupid things is what it came down to. A couple because that I remember.
Manliness equals stupidity. Right.
Yeah. Well, there is this, there is a bit of an
equivalent.
What's equivalence? Thank you.
Yes.
I was going to say equation. So I remember, for example, like one of the manliest man contests.
Are you calling my mustache stupid?
No comment.
My wife would like to thank you.
So, yeah, manliest man, go ahead.
And I remember one of the manliest man contests being that we had to run around the house through this snow barefoot, right? Mm. And what happened is you come back and your feet are shredded. Your feet are cut and beaten and frozen and all these things. But it was how you showed you were a manly man. Mm-hmm. I remember another manly man contest where you had to eat a twig. Sorry. You had to eat a twig, right? Like somebody dared you to eat a stick and you had to eat the stick.
Hey, Joe, where's this going?
Well, Santiago in The Old Man and the Sea is undeniably...
No wonder he barely makes it back to shore. He ate half the boat.
Did he lose the harpoon or did he eat the harpoon?
Yeah, so Santiago, he's undeniably masculine. And even though he's well past his prime, you know, I picture him in my mind being in his 80s in this book. He basically catches this fish and not unlike his arm wrestling contest that he talks about in the book, he essentially outlasts this fish. So he catches him. He has all of this line. It's not on a fishing pole like we would think of it, but instead it's coiled up in the bottom of the boat and Santiago is holding it in both hands and then it's strung across his back. As this marlin that he hooks tows his boat through the Gulf of Mexico, right? Like literally just like pulls his boat along with him. And Santiago sits there standing in his boat, trying to brace himself against this marlin. And Santiago does this for 3 days before he's able to haul the fish in, where he is going through the sea, not sleeping, only eating raw fish. It is him standing against this incredible natural force, really just through perseverance.
So is there kind of equating his manliness to survival, his ability to survive in a hostile environment?
What did this have to do with your 15-minute story? Was there any tie in there? Did you just want to tell us about
manliness?
It's manliness.
It's like being extreme. I think. For better or for worse, manliness is often associated with like being able to do or survive or get through extreme things, whether it's stupid extreme things like eating a twig or kind of maybe rad extreme survival, like getting this fish after 3 days.
Are you saying your interpretation of this book is how manly he is? So women shouldn't read this book is what you're saying.
I think what Hemingway does is he presents... I'm going to make kind of an extreme claim here, so feel free to guffaw.
Do it.
Yeah. I can sense that coming, yeah.
He presents Santiago as the Jesus of manliness.
Right. I kind of wondered if we were going there, yep.
Yeah, Santiago is out in nature. He's facing the elements. He's facing this incredibly worthy natural component. And the only thing that he has is his wit and his cunning and his steadiness and his competence as he faces down this massive marlin.
And it's across his back, right? The cords across his back. Like anytime in literature when something is like strapped across somebody's back, you kind of have to think that there's like some reference to.
Every time I hear these little tidbits, I was like okay, Hemingway. All right, I see what you're doing. Yeah, hey, wink. Hey guys, I'm winking right now.
Hemingway to go.
Hemingway to go. Yeah. So this cord is across his back, and like we get all sorts of Christian symbolism where he has to, like, for example,
he turns the fish into wine.
The sail on his boat, right? Like, he doesn't keep the sail and the mast attached to his boat. He carries it with him to his boat the time. So one of the first things we see Santiago doing is throwing this mast over his shoulder, this crippled old man, and walking to his boat through the village and fastening it there.
Huh. Interesting.
I know you did this in the overview, but can you describe the book a little bit? Can you give us, the kind of the quick arc here?
The old man on the sea follows this old man, Santiago, as
slow down.
As he has gone 84 days without catching a fish, which is a terrible streak for a fisherman.
That's a large number. Yeah.
It might be time to get a new career.
Yeah, he lives in poverty. I mean, he lives in destitute poverty. Like, he doesn't have a pot to cook in. He has this young boy, who kind of takes care of him and helps him get food and looks up to him as a mentor and these things. Well, on the 85th day, Santiago says, look, I know what I'm doing and I'm not as strong as I was, but I think I still can do this, right? Like, I know I am still a cunning fisherman and I can still haul in a great catch. So he goes further out into the Gulf than he's ever gone before, and he hooks this marlin. And the marlin that he hooks is massive. He hooks this marlin. It tows him around the Gulf of Mexico for 3 days, and slowly, through perseverance, through grit, through stubbornness in some ways, Santiago hauls this marlin in. When he catches it, it's too big to get in the boat. It's about 18 feet long.
It's 18 feet?
18 feet
long. Dude, marlins are huge.
Is that physically possible?
Well, so marlins are huge, to Dr. Ian DeYoung's point, to that analysis. Marlins are huge. Even in this fishing village, it is the largest fish that anyone has ever seen. And when he hauls it up on shore, people come around the marlin on the shore, what's left of it after being nipped away and nibbled away and eaten by sharks, and they cannot believe how big it is. It is the biggest fish that anybody in this village has ever seen.
Wait, so, okay, I'm looking at Ernest Hemingway's biography, and it looks like maybe he hadn't had a hit novel-wise since 1940 with For Whom the Bell Tolls. So I'm wondering whether, like, this is maybe also can be read as, like, Hemingway is the old man and he hasn't had a hit in a while, but he thinks he can still cut it. So he can still hack it. And so he goes out and guess what? He hooks a Nobel Prize.
And that's one of the common interpretations that you read of this, right? Good. If we start examining this through Hemingway's through an autobiography or through a biographical lens, it's easy to see Hemingway as the old man. The fish is this piece of work that he's doing, right? Like, because this is Hemingway going and staring down this work every day, right? And
so it's just getting like real meta.
Yeah, it's this fish is this piece of work. There's even speculation that the sharks who pick away at this fish are Hemingway's critics,
Who
come and they can't create anything on their own here, but instead they feast off the work that Hemingway has done here. So there are absolutely biographical interpretations of this.
That's how we view our critics as well.
Our legions of critics.
Yes, the many minnows biting away.
Wait, so Joe, you kind of say it sound like maybe you don't buy that reading. What's your reading of this? Like, why? What's going on here?
So when I reread this,
clearly
book,
some daddy issues.
When I reread this book over the last few days, one of the things that stuck out to me is I really tried to read it through that Hemingway lens of, hey, there's nothing here other than what's on the tin. Right,
like
this book, the Hemming lens. This book does what's on the Hemming tin, and that is it presents a man versus, you know, we talk about different narratives that we get, Ian. Man versus man, man versus nature, man versus all these things.
Man versus
and this
food
book is man, and this book is man.
Diners,
versus,
drives, and dash. Diners, dinners, drives.
Guy Fieri. Man versus Guy Fieri. Joe,
yes.
We keep interrupting you. What's the storyline here? Man versus
symbolism.
I think there's an argument for man versus nature, obviously, here, right? Like, here he is up against the sea, up against this marlin, but it's also man versus himself. And one of the little bit of dialogue we get in this is is Santiago talking to himself. And he talks himself, and very frequently he'll say things out loud where he will say, you know, I can't do it, or I'm too old, or, you know, this fish is going to kill me. But then he'll respond. He'll respond to himself, kind of have like with this one-sided dialogue. He'll respond things like to like quell that voice, to like tamp down that voice. At one point he says, "You are killing me, fish," the old man thought, "but you have a right to. Never have I seen a greater or more beautiful or calmer or more noble thing than you, brother. Come and kill me. I do not care who kills who." And it really is this man who has all these ideal traits of masculinity going up against nature, and all he has is
Hey guys, I just sent you something. Can you just take a look at it real quick? I just need to make sure.
Oh no.
That is what we're looking for.
Oh my, there he is. That's our boy.
Guys, can you please describe what you see right now in full detail?
It's like a Renaissance painting.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's Guy Fieri.
Yeah. Guy Ferrari, please.
Guy Ferrari. Deep sea fishing, it appears, with his son.
Some other person.
Son?
See, you guys might look at this and see some sort of metaphor, but I just see an old man in the sea, in a marlin, and a boy.
This is a side of Guy Fieri I've never seen, because his sunglasses are on the front of his face.
Now, here's a success for our listeners. We're looking at a very successful photo of Guy Ferrari and his son with the marlin on the ocean, big smiles, happy faces.
I do
faces.
Not think that's a marlin. Is that marlin?
You cannot hold a marlin.
Huge, juicy marlin. Joe, do you think if the old man had brought that his assistant along with him, he would be able to take a successful photo like this? But is his hubris that makes him go up by himself in the middle of the ocean and do it all himself? He's got to be a big man, a big guy, big old man. Do it all by himself.
So he doesn't have an assistant with him in the boat because he's not allowed to bring him. The kid's parents said that the old man is too unlucky. Excuse? Yes, too unlucky.
Too unlucky.
And they don't want his bad luck to rub off on the family. So the old man is out fishing by himself in this.
It's hard to not take that personal.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely personal.
At one point, and this is the very last thing I want to say, after he got in two plane crashes, rumors started circulating that Ernest Hemingway had died. And it was after he had published The Old Man and the Sea. And he won the Pulitzer Prize for Old Man and the Sea. And this had all been cleared up at this time. And then he won the Nobel Prize for The Old Man and the Sea. But even then, there's speculation that there was a chip on Ernest Hemingway's shoulder. And he thought that one of the reasons, one of the only reasons he won the Nobel Prize that year, is because this rumor of his death had circulated, and the Nobel Committee looked at that and thought, oh man, we probably should give Ernest Hemingway this before he dies. Ernest Hemingway,
death. That could be a great way to catapult this podcast. Three podcasters die in an airplane crash.
Die in two successive airplane crashes. Give them all of the, what are they called? The potties?
What?
The podcast. The potties. Podcast awards. The potties. Like Emmys, Grammys. Potties.
P-O-D-D-Y. Is that real?
Are there I'm potties? Sure it's not. I think it's called something else.
Yes, the potties. I hope we do get invited to the potties this year.
Speaking of which, I need to go to the potty. I need to go to the potty, so I'll be right back.
Perfect. Oh, great. Good segue. Come back and get ready to talk about your book, Ian.
Yep, you got it.
Hey, I was walking in the park yesterday and I saw a talking frog. Do you guys have any books about that?
Well, I don't have a book about a talking frog, but I have a book about a talking toad. if we're doing talking animals, I'll bring The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham next week.
And I also don't have any talking frogs in my book, but I do have a talking pig, rat, spider. I'd like to bring Charlotte's Web by E.B. White.
So I guess what we're saying, Nick, is no, we cannot help you with your talking frog problem. I would say it's probably a monster or a demon of some sort, and you should definitely call in some professional.
Or your firstborn child is on its way, so maybe some sort of pact is in order where you make a bargain or a wager with this demon. for the soul of your firstborn.
Well,
I thought you were going to say I should bring a talking animal book to read to my child, not making a pact with Satan.
No.
Well, we don't know it's Satan. It sounds probably like a lesser demon.
Okay. Right. Not the man himself.
No.
The man, the myth, the legend.
Lucifer.
All right. Good enough.
That went off.
That's the spirit. Good enough.
Boy, those sound like great suggestions, guys. Thank you.
So The Sun Also Rises is his first major novel, and it's
would you say it's hemming good?
I would say it's hemming great, actually. I would go that far.
Would you give this a 5 hemming star review?
I would. Do you have one? Do you have a 5-star or a 1-star? Because I've got a really interestingly ambiguous review, if you'd like to hear that.
I have a review that's going to make you so angry, Ian. I just want to wait. I want to sit on it.
No, sit on it a little bit. Let's lead off with it, please. I love this.
All right, Ian. It's a kind of a long one. It is a 1-star review from our girl, Sophie. I'm going to need you to stay silent, but here are some rules.
Hey, can I grunt?
Yep, exactly. That's exactly where I was going with this. You are allowed to grunt, sigh, and moan into the microphone loudly, okay?
Okay, great. You got
it. All right, well, here we go. Sit down for this one.
I'm sitting.
I read a quote from this book about when the sun sets, it will always rise again, and I thought that was beautiful, so I decided to read the book. Ernest Hemingway has quite a name, but honestly, I'd rather use this book as toilet paper because it's complete and utter shit.
Is that it? Is that the whole?
God, you said God, no. We're not done. Nothing happens, except for some people going on holiday, fishing, with a bit of drinking on the side. I had expected something extraordinary, with a great word used as descriptions, but unfortunately none of my expectations became reality. So if you're reading this review, I'm telling you right now, please, for your own good, don't read this book. I don't know about you guys, but whenever somebody says nothing happens in a book, TV show, movie, I immediately disregard that person's opinion. Because I don't think you were paying attention. There's no way millions of dollars got green-lighted by all these people and oops, we forgot to write something.
Can you something imagine happened. That pitch?
Yeah, this isn't Seinfeld. I think something does happen. So, Ian, does anything happen in this book?
Yes, a lot of stuff happens.
Okay.
It's sort of so. Like, I think when people say this, nothing happens, they're talking narratively or in terms of plot, as opposed to sort of in terms of character interactions. So, I think in this book, a lot of stuff does happen, both narratively and in terms of characters. There is a whole section of the book, which is the bullfight festival, and that's pretty dramatic. There's this really good bullfighter whose name is Romero, and all the people in the town are like, he's the best bullfighter. He's like a classic, the way the bullfighters used to be. And one of the characters, one of our main characters, kind of falls in love with him and seduces him. And all the Spanish people are like, no, don't seduce our bullfighter. He will become a bad bullfighter. And she's like, I love him so much, though. And so she does seduce him. And guess what? He still is a great bullfighter. And he cuts off the bull's ear and gives it to her as a trophy. So that's a thing
romantic.
That happens.
Romantic.
Yeah.
So, Ian,
I mean, guys, hey, listen, litheads, listen to me. If you have a special someone today, seek them out. Give them the severed ear of the bull you just killed.
Nothing as grand of a gesture.
It's kind of like Van Gogh, but, you know, a bull's ear instead of his own.
Yeah, a lot of similarities between those two things in the sense that there are ears. So, Ian,
there is stuff that happens.
Can you tell us about this book? Let's start from the beginning. In the beginning, tell us about the beginning.
So the beginning, the first chunk of the book, it's not a long book, it's only about 250 pages. The first chunk of the book is establishing these characters and their relationships. So there's our main character, our first person narrator, Jake, and he has a bunch of friends. So there's this girl he has a crush on, this woman he has a crush on. There's this friend of his who he kind of likes but also kind of can't stand. There's the childhood friend that comes along later, who's just super fun and cool. And then there's also the boyfriend of his crush. And the boyfriend is pretty cool, but the first part of this book just establishes the sort of complicated web of relationships and who these people are. And then they go on this fishing trip, and it's going to be all of them, but...
The old man goes only.
Well, so that's funny. It's really interesting. Like, fishing is obviously, in sport in general, is obviously really important to...
Wait, are you fucking with me? Is there really a fishing trip in this book?
Yeah, they don't go out in the ocean. They're in a river in the Basque country. But yeah, they go fishing. So they're going from Paris to Pamplona, Spain, and they stop in the Basque country, and they go on this fishing trip up to this river. And it's like probably some of the nicest, the least kind of cringe part of the book, because it's just they're out in nature, they're fishing, they do really good at fishing, it's beautiful. And he kind of presents this as one of those vacations where you lose track of time. You're just like, you got nothing to do, you got nowhere to be, you just...
Why would you say it's a cringe? I don't understand.
Yeah,
well, they drink so much, they drink so much, and their interactions are so awkward. So like the first slice in the sort of cafe life of Paris, a lot of people are really like attracted to our main character's crush. Brett is her name. A lot of people are attracted to her, and that's kind of like played off as this kind of fun, flirty atmosphere. But there's also like this undercurrent that this sort of lifestyle where everyone is in love with her and she is kind of leading everyone on, and a lot of people are kind of like making fools of themselves in an attempt to catch her eye, this cannot last. And so the first section sort of establishes this. Then we have this interlude of fishing where it's just the guys. There's no women around. And what a surprise for Hemingway. When it's just men together, everything's fine. Like, they just go do their nature stuff and it's all good. And then they go to the festival, to the fiesta, and there's a ton more relationship drama. And people start punching each other.
Hey, just to jump back real quick about your dig on Hemingway. Are you saying he is a total sexist?
Well...
Can we get you on quote on that?
He had four wives.
Yeah.
At the same time?
Like, in succession.
let me tell you a little fact about this book, okay? So Hemingway based this book on interaction, a trip that he took with some friends. So this is what's called a roman à clef. That's terrible French pronunciation. Which means a novel with a key. So certain things happened that happened in real life, and these characters correspond to those real people and so on. He writes this book. Let me get this timeline right. He writes the book. He goes to England. Goes to America, goes to New York with
Guy Ferrari,
someone who helped him, a friend who helped him write it. He starts an affair with her. He comes back to France. His wife leaves him. And then later that year, the book is published. He dedicates the book to his wife who has left him, and gives her all the royalties for it. Aww. So he's got this super like strange relationship with just women in general. Like his books present like women as complicating things, but also these objects of desire. And then like, and when he goes out in nature to fish, it is just a masculine space. It's just dudes, and they do a good job fishing, and they drink their wine, and they eat their lunches, and they kill a lot of fish, and it's great. It's a really, really good time.
This might be a good opportunity for us to just clear the air a little bit and let everybody know that we love the ladies on this podcast. Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Unless
you
guys disagree.
No, I am not a sexist.
Okay. Joe, I'm going to need verbal sign-off.
Verbal confirmation.
This is a verbal contract.
Where do you stand on the sexism question?
Yeah, so I am anti-sexism. My wife would have it no other way.
Good. Yeah, can I go back and revise? When I said I am not a sexist, I would like to also claim I am anti. So it's not just that I'm separate yeah. from that. I am actively opposed to it. Yeah.
I hate him. That's a Hemming fact.
Hemming fact. So this book is, I think, there's a lot of stuff happens in it, but it's worth reading, I think, not because so much because of the cool stuff that happens, but because this captures a particular type of experience, which I'm going to call the 20 something experience. So you guys know this phrase, 20 something. So-and-so is a 20 something. And I think I know that neither of you guys are in your 20s. 20 something is in the past for all of us. Yes. But this is written when he was 24, 25, 26, 27. In there, it's so he is a 20 something. It's about people who are 20 somethings, and it's based on his interactions with people who are this age. And I don't know a lot of other books that I would characterize this way, but I think this is a 20 something book. It's a book about this sort of time in your life. So it's the feeling of like having a crush who's dating someone else, of living in a big town where you have a lot of acquaintances but not many close friends, dealing with your traumas, dealing with your struggles from the past. You make these elaborate plans and then they just kind of unspool, and sometimes they go well, they unspool in positive ways, sometimes in negative ways. There are a lot of parties. Everyone knows
mostly
everyone.
Mostly negatives.
Everyone has been in a relationship with everyone else. This is a big one. Either you are the friend who has like a job, a solvent friend, or you're poor. You're sponging off of them.
The moocher. Yeah.
Right. You either have the couch or you're crashing on the couch. And there's this whole like lifestyle. And like sometimes you just like say, let's go to this, whatever festival it is. Let's just go to it. And you go and you make these memories, and some of them are great memories, but also like you ruin a friendship that way. And there's this kind of weird, weird milieu. Reading this book, it reminded me of like certain elements of my life that I experienced.
Dumb you were in your 20s.
Well, kind of like these people feel strong.
How dumb we all are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is the thing, because like I mentioned, this is a romantic.
Is this a book
novel
about stupid people?
I would say it's a book about you guys. Have you guys heard this term emotional IQ? I think this is about people who have sort of struggles with emotional IQ. There's this one character, Robert, who is in love with Brett. And he just thinks she's the best. And then they kind of go and they spend some time. They like go together to a resort, and like sort of take up together there for a while. And then later she's like, ha ha, it was just for fun. Like we weren't a thing. We weren't serious. But he's still in love with her. And so he like follows them around and he's super awkward. And eventually when they get to the fiesta, she seduces this young bullfighter, and Robert gets really jealous, goes into the room where they are together and starts punching the bullfighter. And the bullfighter is not good at punching back. But he's so masculine. He keeps standing up when it's time, when like he gets knocked down to the ground, he stands up again and he gets knocked down, stands up, knocked down over and over. And he can't like fight back because he's too weak. All he can do is keep on standing up. And I think I kind of wonder if maybe this image of masculinity is a little bit, because he's presented as super masculine, super manly dude.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same idea of like that perseverance or that steadfastness or that resoluteness, just like not giving up is this incredibly masculine trait.
But here it's played for not laughs, but it's kind of like funny a little bit. It's okay, weird that like we reading this, I chuckled aloud, and I'm not going to read it out loud because it's really hard to do that in the audio medium, but like he's just it's just silly. This guy keeps on standing up, and Brett is saying, no, stop it, you don't need to stand up, you don't need to be punched again. And the guy keeps that Robert keeps punching him, and then like this ruins Robert is more beat up than the bullfighter, than Romero. And Robert goes back to his room and he's like, that's it, I'm leaving. And he kind of like separates himself from the whole group. But low emotional IQ and just really maybe sort of troublesome ideas of what it means to be manly, what it means to be desirable.
Yeah, I mean, you could read that as Robert like kind of like railing against something that he can't beat here. Like if you want to read it as him railing against like masculinity itself, or him railing against the situation, right? And it's like, so I like the fact that he's the one that gets beat up, even though he's the one, or beat up in quotes here. He's the one, even though he's the one lashing out.
Hey, Ian.
Yeah.
Why should I read this book? Why is this a good book?
This book, I think, is a valuable echo or a foreshadowing for how people deal with trauma. So this book is written after World War One. Hemingway served in World War One. The characters in this novel have served in war, and like they kind of like mention the war, but Hemingway is like obviously coy about that because he writes in this very sparse style. But I think this is going to be an interesting book to read as we go into the 1920s. Sorry, as we go into the 2020s.
Yeah.
As we time travel.
So I'm excited for the car to be invented.
So like right now in the coronavirus times, we are dealing with a kind of a global trauma. We're dealing with a huge global event that will change the way people growing up right now, people learning how to be socializing adults, live in the world. So I'm really interested to see sort of how this novel picks up, maybe picks up some relevance in a world where people are excited to be socializing again. People are excited to be interacting again. And as we discussed, people who are of a certain age often behave in similar ways, like the 20-something.
Ready to get down, yeah. Yeah.
So,
are you like, thinking a lot of babies in 2022 is what you're saying?
No, I don't know. It's just really interesting, though, the way that this novel has already been sort of appropriated by people who are traumatized by the Vietnam conflict. And I think we're coming up to a new set of 20s. And I think these characters' experiences will either speak for the new global trauma, or they might differ from the new global trauma. So like maybe we'll find ourselves and we'll see people of a certain age, people of a certain generation coming of age during coronavirus and then trying to cope in a world that has been like kind of turned on its head. Either it's going to really resemble these characters, or we're going to say, wow, 100 years has changed us. It's like kind of like an experiment. It's like a historical experiment. Like, ooh, which way will we go? In the 1920s, we can say, okay, 20s, we had the global trauma in the teens, end of the teens. And then the 1920s, they responded in these ways. Now, here we are, similar situation, starting a new decade. We're dealing with global trauma. The world is being turned on its ear. How are people going to respond? And I wouldn't be surprised if people respond the same way. Like if these,
I know how
if
this will
stuff,
go.
If this stuff rings
same
true,
way. How, nothing yeah. will change.
Right. And it's like people are people. And this is not a very flashy way to sell the book, but I think I feel like it's true. And I have the suspicion that this is, he gets at something with his very simple writing, his simple language. People thought this novel, like critics thought the novel was like way too simple. They're like, where's
did
the complexity?
Did we stumble into a really relevant book? Is this did we accidentally make this relevant? Is this like a book that's like about getting together with groups of people and having a good time or a bedtime?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
There's something to look forward to then. There's a quote.
Maybe.
There's a quote. I went skiing with extended family just before, like the weekend before everything shut down. In March, kind of out here in the West. And I remember I have such vivid memories of that because like there were so many people together. And like I have not been in a large gathering like that since. And he has this quote, which I think speaks so beautifully to sort of this vibe of the last peaceful event before something splinters, before something goes off. They're having dinner. And he says, it was like certain dinners I remember from the war. There was much wine, an ignored tension, and a feeling of things coming that you could not prevent happening. So it's like, we're having a good time, but the world is looming outside, and it's going to happen. Stuff will break apart. It's going to come. Like,
isn't it fascinating when you hear like somebody famous served in a war? Like, yeah. That to me is like one of the most altering views like that can happen on somebody. It's like, oh yeah, here's Hemingway. Also, he was in the First World War.
Right.
Well, it's like, well, that's a completely different shift.
I mean, what I think is fascinating is when you hear a quote that is 100 years old at this point, that is timely and relevant. I mean, Nick, you're laughing about like, hey, I know how this is going to happen. If you want to know what's going to happen next, just look at what's happened before, right? Because right. history repeats itself and people are people. And here, I think it's crazy.
That's pretty that profound, take, Joe. You well, picked that up?
Thank you, yes.
What's past is prologue, yeah.
Yeah, and here we do have this quote from 100 years ago, and we can all identify it as something that we felt 3 months ago at this right. point. Right?
This is like a really good prequel. You haven't talked about bullfighting at all.
I talked about the bullfighter. He's really good at bullfighting. It's really, it's
you
fast.
Talk
you
about
can tell.
Bullfighting?
Okay, you can tell the things that Ernest Hemingway really likes and cares about because he actually describes them, and you can tell the things that he doesn't really give a crap about. So there's this really, I marked it in my book, there's this really funny moment where they're in Spain. I want to get it exactly right. Here we go. So they get into the area of the Basque country, and they notice a monastery up on the hillside. Harris was there, and the three of us walked up to Roncesvalles. We went through the monastery. It's a remarkable place, Harris said when we came out. Like, that's all he gives you. He's like,
it's like I'm there.
It's just so like, Hemingway does not care about the monastery. But the bullfighting, he gives you like technical breakdowns of like the way that he shifts his weight, the way his motions are fluid, the way he gets this one particular bull to behave in this one particular way. It's very sort of...
Would this be on PETA's official list of books to read?
Bullfighting is super unethical.
Yeah, pretty bad.
It's kind of weird. It's like, it's not like he describes this so beautifully and he's obviously fascinated by it. And it's a part of the cultural history, but it's so like, they're just stabbing these bulls. It's super complicated.
It's canceled, right? There's no way bullfighting is going to make it out of this year.
That's how we get our podcast canceled, is by talking about bullfighting.
Yeah.
But he has these beautiful evocative descriptions with incredibly simple language, right? We think back to our literary fights back in the day where Hemingway says, like, I know the $10 words, but I use the simple words, these older, better words.
Right. Well, it's really like, he can do so much with short words, short phrases. Like, this is not a book. He wrote this around the same time as what's that?
Short books too. I mean, it's like 200 pages, exactly. You said. Are all of his books that short?
I think some of them are a little bit longer.
Coincidentally,
I think some of them are longer.
Yeah,
but like he writes short and he writes easy to get. This is written the same time as Ulysses is, and actually Joyce and Hemingway used to go out drinking together, and when Joyce would get in bar fights, Joyce would say, hey, Ernest, come, can help me out. And then Ernest Hemingway would just like go punch he'd win the bar fight. So this is written in the same time as Ulysses and in the same kind of literary crowd, but it's so different in terms of like, he's not trying to be complex. He's not trying to be like intricate. He's just like, here's what you get. What you see is what you get. And here's what I saw. And now you're seeing it too.
Ian, is there anything else you'd like to share with us today? Do you have any more Heming facts?
Oh, you bet I do.
Ooh, all right. Got some.
Why don't you end? Hey, Ian.
Yeah.
I think tonally, I just heard Joe lost, which he did. Congratulations, Ian. Can you end us with a Heming fact and a quote?
Yes.
Okay. Sophie, with her one-star review, it sounds like he didn't necessarily refute what she was saying. It sounds like a bit of a coming of age. But it's his first book. I think you got to read the first book by any first piece of work by any great creator or any great author, you know, director, movie maker.
And then you can understand. Then you can understand Old Man and the Sea. I think reading this and then Old Man and the Sea is a really interesting pairing. Okay, here is a Heming fact to close us out. There is a yearly Hemingway lookalike contest, which I have lost by shaving all of my facial hair.
Shit, should I join?
You probably could. I don't think you'd win because you got to be like old and have white hair. It's in Key West at the Sloppy Joe's bar where Hemingway used to drink in the 1930s. And you go and you try and look like Hemingway.
And you go drink, yeah.
Yep. Here is a quote, and it is characteristically short. It is awfully easy to be hard-boiled about everything in the daytime, but at night, it is another thing.